This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello everyone, this is Bill Von Nahar with continuing stories for our Moments in History broadcast. Today we're going back to the Cincinnati Enquirer to our favorite history writer, Jeff Seuss, who writes for the Enquirer. And today we're going to read one that was published in the Enquirer on April 7th, 2024. Headlines is Tornadoes Brought Historic Damage. Xenia and Blue Ash were victimized 25 years apart, he says. He begins, the severe weather this past week served as a reminder of our sometimes volatile relationship with Mother Nature. People pay close attention to dark gray skies this time of year. Tornado season in Ohio typically runs from April through June, but the fiercest storms always seem to arrive here in early April. In less than a week's time, we mark two anniversaries of the deadliest tornadoes that hit the region, 25 years apart. 50 years ago, on April 3, 1974, a super outbreak hit the Midwest. Over a 24-hour period, a total of 148 tornadoes touched down across 13 states in a swath from Alabama to Ontario, Canada. There were 335 people killed, with 179 of the fatalities in Ohio, Kentucky, and Indiana. The harshest of these twisters struck Xenia, Ohio, a small city of 25,000, about 15 miles east of Dayton. The name Xenia would be forever associated with that tragic day. A quarter of a century later, another deadly tornado touched down in Montgomery and Blue Ash in suburban Cincinnati. A quarter of a century after that, these dark days are still with us. 1974 tornado outbreak. Half of Xenia was gone. It was a warm spring afternoon. School was over for the day, and soon the workday would be done also. Families were setting the table for supper. Then the sky grew ominous. Charcoal clouds with a greenish hue. Most people didn't know what was coming their way. Xenia didn't have any tornado sirens at the time, and weather detecting technology was primitive by today's standards. Doppler radar wasn't yet widely used. This tornado outbreak would change that. There were none of the early warning signs that we now have. No cell phones with news alert impinging in our ears. At 4:07 p.m., the National Weather Service radar at the Cincinnati Northern Kentucky International Airport spotted a possible tornado with its signature hook-shaped image on the radar screen. At 4:30 p.m., WLWT meteorologist Bob Breck interrupted the program to broadcast a tornado warning on Channel 2 in Dayton. He was the first to warn the public. 10 minutes later, a tornado ravaged Xenia. The funnel tore through downtown and wiped out 200 homes of the Arrowhead subdivision. Then it hit Wilberforce and Cedarville. The tornado was rated an F5, which is the highest measure on the scale of damage. It whipped up 300 mile-per-hour winds that shattered hundreds of homes and business buildings. In Xenia alone, 32 people were killed. 1,000 were injured and thousands were homeless. About 50% of Xenia's gone, Xenia Police Chief Ray Jordan declared that day. There is debris all over the place. Windows gone. Trees gone. Wires down. Xenia High School was reduced to rubble. Some school buses were picked up by the wind and hurled three blocks. The clocks were struck at 4:40 p.m. Thankfully, the schools were already empty by that time. Debris from Xenia was found as far as 200 miles from the city. A Penn Central train was derailed across Main Street. Impending relief efforts, impeding relief efforts from the Ohio National Guard. In anniversary coverage 5 years, 5 years ago, meteorologist Ben Gelber in Columbus summed up the historic tornado. It was just an unthinkable storm in terms of size, magnitude, and tragedy. And that wasn't the only tornado that hit southwest Ohio that day. Second tornado hit Sailor Park in northern Kentucky. Another F5 tornado clobbered Sailor Park on Cincinnati's west side along the river. A two-block area of Holmes Avenue was devastated. Cars were upside down, trees were felled, and it was impossible to tell what debris belonged to which house, the Enquirer reported. One man said it was like a bomb raid that he experienced in the military. A Sailor Park woman described her experience with the twister. "I was walking down the stairs when it happened. The lights went out, and then it just went whoosh. The roof and insulation and glass all flew into the courtyard. I didn't do anything. I just stood there saying, 'Oh my goodness, oh my goodness.' It was over in a flash." A Covington patrolman saw the V-shaped clouds zipping back and forth across the Ohio River. Power and telephone lines were knocked out at the Weather Service office at CVG, so there was no updated reports. Hebron in Boone County was hit hard, as was Dent and other parts of Greene Township, plus Roselawn, Mason, and Blue Ash. There were 5 deaths in Hamilton County. Picking up the pieces. President Richard Nixon visited Xenia a few days later and was surprised by the level of damage. He pledged that federal aid would be coming. Nixon later cited Xenia as an example to Congress of the need to pass the Disaster Relief Act of 1974. Despite the devastation and upheaval, the world kept turning. Cincinnati Reds opening day at Riverfront Stadium took place the day after the tornadoes. "It seems so soon to be playing games again," Enquirer sports columnist Tom Callahan wrote. "Not even a full day had gone by. That's hardly enough time to cry. Shouldn't there be more lull after storms like Wednesday's?" he said. In the first inning, Hank Aaron of the Atlanta Braves belted his 714th home run to match the all-time record held by Babe Ruth. Pete Rose, who grew up in Sailor Park, who had just been smashed by a tornado, scored the winning run. Then neighbors helped neighbors. Xenia rebuilt, as did Sailor Park, Hebron, and elsewhere. The community survived, but never forgot. A tornado hit Montgomery and Blue Ash in 1999. 6 days after the 25th anniversary of these tornadoes, Cincinnati was forced into a sequel. Shortly before 5:30 a.m. on April 9th, 1999, an F4 tornado broadsided Montgomery and Blue Ash. Winds topping 260 miles per hour destroyed more than 200 homes and businesses. 4 people were killed. Tornado signs did go off, but it was so early in the morning that many people just slept through them. Donald Bush Jr. was driving southbound on I-71, heading to work that Friday morning. "I saw a couple of bright flashes, 2 big balls of blue. I guess they were transformers blowing. The rain was picking up. You couldn't see anything. It was like driving in a cloud. Then it was like the truck took control of itself. The wind lifted his truck and set it upside down on a concrete barrier in the freeway median." Enquirer photographer Craig Ruddle, heading out to photograph the devastation, came across the flipped-over truck and stopped. He found Bush sitting nearby. "I'm definitely feeling lucky. I never heard it coming," Bush said. Another driver in a wreck across the interstate wasn't as fortunate. He was ejected from the car when it was blown into some trees. Unfortunately, he was pronounced dead at the scene. No matter how many times you've seen something like this, you still are shocked by the ferocity and how quickly these things take place, Ruddle told the Enquirer. It was just minutes from total normalcy to total chaos. The damage didn't really become clear to me until the light came up. Trees were snapped like matchsticks. Those that were not uprooted were stripped of their bark. Houses lost roofs and walls collapsed. Mattresses and insulation hung from the branches. A couple, Lee and Jacqueline Cook, were asleep in their second-story bedroom when high winds hit their home on Cornell Road. Their bodies were found in a field across the street. A photograph of their old English sheepdog tied to an overturned Chevrolet Blazer appeared in the newspaper. A veterinarian recognized the dog, Blaney, and offered to take him in. He was suffering from a fractured pelvis and a broken heart. So was the rest of the community. All that was left was picking up the pieces. And that's the article written by Jeff Seuss in the Enquirer on April 7th, 2024. Tornadoes Brought Historic Damage was the name of the article. We have another article from Jeff Seuss. This is in the April 21st edition of the Enquirer, and it's entitled Famed Astronomer's Path Led Him to Cincinnati. It begins, if you saw the total solar eclipse earlier this month, you might have noticed that what they call the diamond ring effect just before totality. The last rays of sunlight peeked through the mountains of the moon, creating beads of light. The final couple beads appeared as shining diamonds on a bright ring around the moon's silhouette. Those were known as Bailey's beads, named after English astronomer Francis Bailey, who first observed the phenomenon during a total eclipse of the sun May 15, 1836. His vivid descriptions of the effect led to the popularity of the next eclipse in 1842. Bailey, born in Berkshire, England, in 1774, was one of the founders of the Royal Astronomical Society and served as its president. What does he have to do with Cincinnati history, you might ask? Well, when he was 21 years old, Bailey set off on a two-year tour of North America during the early years of the United States, including stops in Cincinnati and through Kentucky country. In 1856, several years after Bailey's death in 1844, his writings about the trek were published by Augustus De Morgan under the title Journal of a Tour in Unsettled Parts of North America in 1796 and 1797. At the time of Bailey's visit, Cincinnati was less than a decade old, founded in December 1788. Most of the surrounding territory was wilderness. Cincinnati was part of the Northwest Territory before Ohio was admitted to the Union in 1803. Travel was difficult in the early days of the United States. Bailey embarked on a journey to America on October 21, 1795. After several months at sea, he made it to Norfolk, Virginia. Over the next 2 years, he traveled throughout the United States. There were just 16 states in 1796, and much of the western country. He visited the established eastern cities, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York, where he found some places still showed the scars of battle from the Revolutionary War. He headed west on September 1, 1796, starting at the new city of Washington, D.C., founded just a few years earlier in 1790. Travel in the late 18th century was arduous and slow. There were no freeways, no railroads, no canals. Roads were unpaved. Riverboats were powered by oars, not steam yet. In the eastern states, travel between cities was by coach. Roads were agreeable in the summer, but had great difficulties in the winter. Travel in the western frontier was by wagons and horseback over the Appalachian Mountains until they reached the Ohio River. But the river was frozen in the winter months, and they had to camp out in small settlements for weeks at a time. Once the frozen river broke up, they floated down a nearly constructed boat 13 feet wide and 40 feet long, boarded at both sides and covered at the top all the way except at the front, which was left open for the horses and for the men to row. On February 27, 1797, the boat arrived at Columbia, which had preceded Cincinnati as a settlement by 2 months. It is now Cincinnati's Columbia-Tusculum neighborhood. Columbia, Bailey wrote, was never in a very flourishing state. The neighboring and well-settled country round in at Cincinnati prevents it from being a place of any great importance. Besides, it lies very low and is often overflowed from the river, which prevents any houses being built immediately on the banks, as is customary in these new settlements. Based on his observation of several frontier colonies, Bailey described what he called the first class of settlers, the pioneers who purchase a tract of uncultivated land to start a new life. A race of people rough in their manners, impatient of restraint, and of independent spirit, who are taught to look upon all men as their equals, and no farther worry of respect from them than their conduct deserves. They are a race which delight much to live on the frontiers, where they can enjoy undisturbed and free from the control of any laws the blessing which nature has bestowed upon them. When the second class arrived, a little more refined, the first group typically sold their stakes and moved on to another frontier. It was not until the third class arrived that any kind of society emerged. On April 3rd, Bailey put his luggage in a canoe and rowed down river about 6 miles to Cincinnati. He described Cincinnati of that time as built partly on the bottom, that is, near the river, and partly on the second bank, the flatter basin area of downtown. Cincinnati may contain about 300 or 400 houses, mostly frame-built, he wrote. The inhabitants are chiefly employed in some way of business, of which there is a great deal here transacted, the town being the metropolis of the Northwest Territory. This is a grand depot for the stores which come down from the forts established on the frontiers. On the second bank, not far from the fort, that is Fort Washington, there are the remains of an old fortification with some mounds not far from it. It is of a circular form, and by walking over it, I found the mean diameter to be 312 paces or 780 feet, which makes the circumference nearly half a mile. This was probably the ancient burial mound near Fifth Street that Dr. Daniel Drake described in his 1815 book, Natural and Statistical View or Picture of Cincinnati and the Miami Country. That mound was obliterated by the development of Cincinnati. The site now contains Fountain Square and Carew Tower. At Yateman's Tavern, Bailey met with Judge Jacob Burnett, who proffered an invitation to accompany him to New York and Niagara Falls, but Bailey chose to continue towards New Orleans. While aboard a flatboat headed to Louisville, Bailey's group spotted a canoe on the river that pulled alongside them. It contained but one old man, accompanied by his dog and his gun, and a few things lying at the bottom of the canoe, Bailey wrote. We called to him to come into our boat, which he accordingly did, and after a little conversation our guest proved to be old Colonel Brown, the first discoverer of the new flourishing state of Kentucky. I was extremely happy to have an opportunity of conversation with the hero of so many adventures. Daniel Boone, the spelling of his name had not yet been formalized, was already a legend. His exploits were first published in the book The Discovery, Settlement, and Present State of Kentucky by John Filson, one of Cincinnati's founders. That account by his adventures was reprinted in a book by Gilbert Imlay, and Bailey had a copy of that book with him. I read it over to Boone, and he confirmed all that was related about him, Bailey wrote. I could observe the old man's face brighten up at the mention of any of these transactions in which he had taken so active a part. I was much pleased with the old man's conversation, as he appeared to be one who had seen a great deal of world, though in the most uncultivated state. Nevertheless, being a man of strong natural parts, his observation on the different objects which had passed before him rendered the half hour he stopped with us very interesting and amusing. Bailey's journal writings of the tour were unpublished in his lifetime. De Morgan noted that if they had been published when written, they would have made him a name among enterprising travelers and might have changed his career and enabled him to a further travels. Indeed, his path took him elsewhere in the state. And that's the end of the article that was written by Jeff Seuss, famed astronomer's path led him to Cincinnati. And we found that article in the Enquirer, April 21st, 2024. Since we still have some time left, we're going to go to historic trivia. What I'm going to read is History's Mysteries. Can you solve this quiz about unsolved mysteries? I'm going to read two of them, give you some time to think about it, talk about it, and then come back and provide the answer that you probably already know. First one, what legendary island civilization, first mentioned by Plato, supposedly sank in the ocean and has never been found again? I'll read that again. What legendary island nation, first mentioned by Plato, supposedly sank into the ocean and has never been found again? Think about that. What could that be? While you're thinking about that, listen to this one. In 1888, his murders of women terrorized the East End of London. What's the alias of the still unidentified serial killer? In 1888, his murders of women terrorized the East End of London. So what is the alias of this still unidentified serial killer? Who's got the answers to those two? First one, let's go back and review that. What legendary island civilization that was first mentioned by Plato supposedly sank into the ocean and has never been found again? That would have been, I think I hear somebody saying, that would have been Atlantis. Atlantis is the answer. Very good. Next one. In 1888, his murders of women terrorized the East End of London. So what is the alias of this still unidentified serial killer? Well, that would have been, the alias would have been Jack the Ripper. Jack the Ripper was the answer for that one. You got that. Good. Ingrid Bergman won an Oscar in the film about which daughter of Tsar Nicholas II, the lost Grand Duchess of Russia. Ingrid Bergman won an Oscar in the film about which daughter of Tsar Nicholas II, the lost Grand Duchess of Russia. While you're thinking about that, talking about that, who was the first explorer to notice that there was something really spooky about the Bermuda Triangle? So who was the first explorer to notice that there was something really spooky about the Bermuda Triangle? How about Ingrid Bergman won an Oscar in the film about which daughter of Tsar Nicholas II, the lost Grand Duchess of Russia? That would have been, who's got the answer? That would have been Anastasia. Anastasia. Very good. All right. Moving on. Who was the first explorer to notice that there was something really spooky about the Bermuda Triangle? That would have been who? That would have been, yes, that's right, Christopher Columbus. Christopher Columbus. Moving on to the next one. Inspired by the mystery of Bastille prisoner whose identity was kept secret by King Louis XIV, Alexandre Dumas wrote a novel entitled What? Inspired by the mystery of a Bastille prisoner whose identity was kept secret by King Louis XIV, Alexandre Dumas wrote a novel entitled What? And while you're thinking about that, What Canadian brigantine became the ghost ship after it was found in Spanish waters in pristine shape? By whose captain and crew had vanished? What Canadian brigantine became the ghost ship after it was found in Spanish waters in pristine shape, but whose captain and crew had vanished? Going back to that first one, who's got the answer for it? Inspired by the mystery of a Bastille prisoner whose identity was kept secret by King Louis XIV, Alexandre Dumas wrote a novel entitled What? And the novel was The Man in the Iron Mask. That's right, Alexandre Dumas, The Man in the Iron Mask. And this next one I did not know, but I'm sure some of our listeners know. What Canadian brigantine became the ghost ship after it was found in Spanish waters in pristine shape? By whose captain, but whose captain and crew had vanished? And that would have been the Mary Celeste. The Mary Celeste. And I think we got time for perhaps one more. In 2007, Gordon Holmes took videos of what unknown creature that was said to swim beneath the waters of Scotland's largest lake. In 2007, Gordon Holmes took videos of what unknown creature that's said to swim beneath the waters of Scotland's largest lake. And the answer is what? The answer is Nessie, or the Loch Ness Monster. Nessie, they called it Nessie, or the Loch Ness Monster. But I think we're coming up the end of our time, but we do appreciate you listening, and they tell me that people really enjoy the trivia questions. So until next time, this is Bill Von der Haar with Moments in History. Thank you for listening.